populations of other species, the study's authors say, can recover genetic diversity given enough time and space. Nate Rott, NPR News.
The Winter Paralympics are underway in Italy. Organizers say 665 athletes from around the world will compete in 79 medal events. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
Welcome to The Conversation on WVIK, a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Melinda Pavek. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll stick around for this week's conversation on Quad Cities NPR WVIK. Well, Melinda Pavek, we welcome you back to the Middle West with some strains of old retro theme music.
It's a delight to be here, Kai, and I am dancing along. I love the music.
Well, we're grateful to have you. Now, Melinda, this is one of these special conversations that I get to have with people whose careers I have had a chance to observe, usually from afar, but nonetheless with great awe and admiration. And that's what I think our friends listening today are going to pick up. But I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, even though as our promotion has been saying on the air here at WVIK, you are a retired senior Foreign Service officer with the United States State Department. There's a fascinating path that we've got to tread to get there. So if you don't mind, I'm going to rewind a little bit and ask you where that path began.
Well, I had the pleasure of being born to a wonderful set of parents in Shakopee, Minnesota, which is a small town. Well, it was a small town when I grew up there, like something between 6 and 10,000 people, but it's much larger now. It's now become a suburb of Minneapolis.
And that is a fascinating evolution to see happen. I mean, in my lifetime, I remember when cornfields came right up to the downtown of Naperville, Illinois, and now it's just one continuing megalopolis, it seems. But so from Shakopee, which it seems like an idyllic place to grow up, actually, I'm going to slow down here a little bit. What were some of the things that you grew up experiencing or finding your passion sparked in school, maybe subjects that might explain the story we're going to get into in a little bit? Because Shakopee is a beautiful part of the country, but you have pursued a path that has made the world a lot smaller.
Well, Kai, I'm going to admit to something that might be a little bit embarrassing. But you know what? I know it's just the two of us talking, and I trust you.
There's a couple people listening in, but that's all right.
One of my favorite places when I was growing up in Shakopee was the public library. Mm. And so I was a voracious book reader, and I read everything there was. And my mom would take me to the library once a week. And, you know, some people would go into the library and take a couple of books out. I'd go into the library and like have a bag full, you know. I think I was maxed out at 20 books a week or something that I was allowed to take out. And so I will say, looking back, I read a lot of like sort of mental crap in some ways.
That's all right.
But a lot of what I read was sort of historic. You know, historic fiction, just things that got my mind inspired to think about the broader world and opportunities. And so I always thought that I wanted to have a chance to travel and see some of those places. And I guess that's kind of what got me inspired to think more broadly than just staying in Minnesota.
And travel you did. Part of that journey, though, was coming downriver to this particular place. How is it that your path wound from Shakopee to the Quad Cities?
That's a great question. And it's all thanks to the wonderful recruiters of Augustana and them not only being great recruiters, but also being super kind human beings. I'm the oldest in my family, the oldest of three daughters. And I am also one of the first members of my family to look at going to college. And so my parents didn't really have a good sense of how to guide that. But my high school guidance counselor said, you should go to the convention center where you'd have a chance to talk with a lot of different colleges and identify what's the right place for you. So my mom very dutifully drove me to the convention center, and we walked into this enormous room with just, you know, thousands of booths, and I had no idea what to do. And my mother very helpfully turned to me and said, now what? And so we stood there sort of like deer in headlights. And thankfully, Augustana is toward the front of the alphabet. And the recruiter came over and said, it looks like you might need some help. How can I help you? And so to this day, I hadn't before that point heard of Augustana, but we had a really good conversation. And the recruiter was really kind to sort of help to define how to break up the whole convention center. And then also, of course, as we were talking, identified that Augustana really, you know, sort of fit in my selection set and I should take a look. And so I will say that when it came time to choose a location to go to school, I had other options, but definitely my parents both said, Melinda, there is something about Augustana that is special.
Well, I'm grateful for that. And I'm also trying to couch this in the sense that when I really started to follow your career, you were just wrapping up your training. You had been accepted as a Foreign Service officer, but in fact, we met at Foggy Bottom in the State Department for an extended interview. I mean, I knew who you were beforehand, but that's when I really started to know your story a little bit better. What I'd like to know is when that path became clear, because, in other words, what did you study at when you were an undergrad, and how did that sort of fit into the trajectory you would take from the hallowed halls of Rock Island?
Well, as you may remember, I graduated from Augustana in 1992. And at that point, I had taken the Foreign Service exam once and I had failed it, but by a very, very, very small margin. And so I was, you know, I knew I was interested in the Foreign Service, but I didn't have the chance to pursue it or move forward at that point. So I went to teach English in Japan and ended up staying there for about 5 years. And then when I had kind of reached the end of my, not the end of my interest, but I just didn't feel like I was growing anymore in that role, I came back to Minnesota and worked for a language translation company for a number of years, and then went to the University of Minnesota, the Carlson School, to get my MBA. I studied operations, supply chain, and strategy while I was there. And within the first couple of weeks of being at the University of Minnesota, 9/11 happened. And so suddenly our MBA magazine had an advertisement from Colin Powell saying, we want you. Now, I had tried a number of times between graduating in 92, and this was 2001, of course, I tried a number of times to take the exam. I had passed the exam and then done the what they called the oral assessment at that stage a couple of times, but I had not advanced in my opportunities to the State Department. And so when I saw this advertisement from Colin Powell saying, we want you, I was like, really? Because you haven't wanted me so far. But I decided to sit the exam anyway and see what happened. And I was grateful to pass the exam that year. And then at that point, the State Department also realized that they would like to recruit people from a broad range of geographic locations. They were no longer interested in only focusing on pale male in Yale, which had been the long time approach. And so they were doing, they had what was called diplomats in residence at different universities around the country. And we didn't have one at the University of Minnesota, but there was somebody who covered our region. And so they came to the University of Minnesota and found that there were a number of people who had passed the exam and were looking at how they could prepare. And so I went to one of those preparation sessions, and lo and behold, there was another member of my MBA class that was also there. And so she and I identified that we were both interested, and we sat down and we started preparing together. So I will say that that was probably one of the most important aspects of getting into the Foreign Service was really taking it seriously, understanding that an all-day long oral interview that has a series of different portions needs a different kind of job search preparation. And so my colleague and I both took it very seriously, and we both ended up getting into the Foreign Service at that point.
Wow. Now, before we move any further, I have heard that that Foreign Service exam is like one of the most challenging, demanding examinations for acceptance into a program that you'll ever encounter. Is that the case? Is it really that challenging?
The Foreign Service exam changes over time in order to identify the right people that are being, you know, the State Department would like to attract, the types of skills they would like to attract. So I would say it's, in some ways, it's sort of like Trivial Pursuit, that in some cases, you either know the answer or you don't. Or in some cases, if you understand enough about the way the world works, the way geography works, the way the economy works, you can sort of suss out what possible options there are and make an informed choice. So I would say it's definitely worth taking. There were a lot of people for a long time who took it every year just to see if they could pass it. You know, it does have that sense. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's difficult if there are topics that you're not interested in. But if there are topics that you're interested in, and you read the news and you understand how our government works and those kinds of things, it's not as challenging as some might make it out to be.
Yeah. Wow. Well, okay. So now it happens that this is where I really started to get to know a little bit more about this. It was in the early 00s, and I'm sure you remember better than I do, but at the time I was writing the college's alumni magazine, and we wanted to do a special feature on the many people who had left this institution and gone to serve our nation in one way or another in the District of Columbia. So one was a classmate of mine who was working for our national science apparatus in facilitating visits by the world scientists, that sort of thing. And another was a retired CIA employee. It was a lot of fun across the board, but none were more fun than interviewing you, because I think you were just at those final stages before the career really takes off, if I'm remembering correctly. And what I remember most vividly, though, is that you agreed to meet at the State Department offices in Foggy Bottom in D.C., and I show up, and of course, for the college magazine, I have to snap a picture or two. And we were immediately told no cameras were allowed there. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'm going to cost her career before it even starts. I was so afraid I was going to get you in trouble.
You know, I think there are enough people that make that mistake that you know, the security team thinks that if they give you a mean enough face, they they'll stop misbehavior. Yes, but I do remember that too, and I remember thinking, oh well, you know what? Sometimes it's easier to apologize than get permission.
I think we used the picture anyway.
I know.
It was in the Hall of Flags. Yes,
exactly. And that's a public location. Yeah. So it's, I didn't get into, to my knowledge, I didn't get into any trouble.
There's a secret file somewhere, right? So, but do please, if you can, refresh my memory, because you hadn't had an international posting at that point. Is that correct?
No, that's correct. I was still in the early stages of
Okay.
doing what we call our orientation. At that point, it was called our A100, but now it's called an orientation class. So I was just finishing that, and I think maybe I had completed my or I had maybe gotten the information that I was going to Nepal as my first assignment.
Nepal. Okay. And that's what I really am looking forward to getting into with you because I love travel. I think many people who, especially folks who listen to public radio stations, they love to explore and investigate. But there can't be anything that is a corollary to being a foreign service officer of no matter what nation. But when you're in another place, you're constantly just being immersed in the newness of it all. So starting in Nepal, I imagine it was at the capital, Kathmandu.
I was in Kathmandu, yes,
So
from
what an exotic
2004
name.
until, until 2006, and it was a fascinating time to be there. There was still some Maoist activity in the areas around the capital, but and they hadn't had an election for a number of years, and so the parliament was operating, but it was operating sort of out of electoral status. The king, while I was there, got sort of frustrated with that they couldn't make progress on having elections because of the security situation. And while I was there, the king locked down, basically took over the country, which was a unique and interesting thing to experience in my first tour.
And I want to learn about the other things too, but for starting right there, I mean, I just wonder what is the role of a person in your position? I mean, let's face it, every government is dysfunctional to one degree or another. And it's that great line, I think my guest last week even might have referenced it from Churchill, that democracy is terrible, except that it beats every other possible option. But
Yeah, so true.
when you're in a situation like that where there's going to be dysfunction, how does that shape your role as a representative of the United States?
Well, it depends on what your function is within the embassy or the consulate that you're working in. And at that time, I was what was called an assistant general services officer. And so my responsibility was motor pool, housing, procurement, transportation, warehousing. So I did a lot of things that were internal to the embassy, but critical. One of in that particular situation, other vehicles were not allowed to drive on the city streets once the king took over, but our diplomatic plated vehicles were allowed to drive. And so we were able to sort of set up transportation connections for our team, who were spread all across the valley, both our American staff and our local staff. We had to make sure that some of the life-saving necessities, water, fuel, generator transport, because a lot of in Nepal at the time, there was a lot of challenges with electrical power generation. And so there was load shedding. You'd have power for an hour and then not have power for 2 hours. And so we provided generators that required diesel fuel in order to operate when the power would go down. And so there were just a lot of things that we needed to figure out how to do these things. And the most challenging part of that situation was that the government shut down all of the cell phone networks. And so we were forced to operate via landlines, which even at that point was not very, were not used as much and were not as reliable. And also over radio systems, which of course we provided radios for our American officer teams, but and their families, but we had to make sure that we were able to communicate with all of our staff. And so, yeah, that was definitely an early bath in crisis communications and logistics, really. I mean, I did my supply chain MBA, and really, supply chain is all about making sure you have the right things in the right place at the right time for the right mission. And so I learned how to do that early on.
And it's just amazing as you're talking to think about the myriad of details to keep an organization like that running. Okay, so you get that, and I like that immersion image, right? So after Nepal, before we go any further, you kind of referenced this earlier, but you must have a great facility with languages. Did they prep you that way for language in Nepal? Because where does English fit in their language scheme?
So in the State Department then, now it's a little different, but then really the language training that you received was dependent on the job that you were going to be performing. Mm. And so since most of my job in Nepal was considered embassy internal, I didn't receive any formal language training for Nepal.
Okay.
Although I did manage to convince the department to give me sort of a lunchtime fast course. So and a number of other training courses I needed to take before I could go to Nepal. And so I was able to connect with a Nepali teacher at lunchtime over the course of about a month and learn some basics. But unfortunately, no, I didn't get very much language training while I was in the State Department. I came in with Japanese at a level that got me off of what's called language probation. You have to demonstrate that you have a language at a certain aptitude or a certain level before you can get tenured. Mm. And so I proved that with Japanese. And then I didn't get any language training again until I actually went to Japan in 2017. And then I was able to get some Japanese to get my aptitude up to the next required level to get into the Senior Foreign Service.
So how did you start with the Japanese? Did you do Asian studies at Augustana, or how did you pick that up?
I did do Asian studies at Augustana, okay. But you know what, Kai? I studied Mandarin.
Oh, good for you.
Yes. because I had studied German in high school, okay. And I didn't really find it that exciting. And so I studied Mandarin, and I really enjoyed it. I actually did 3 years at Augie in Mandarin. Hmm. And then when it was time to graduate, the economy in the U.S. wasn't that great in 91 to 92. Mm. And so I started looking at other career opportunities, and I got an opportunity with the JET program.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so I ended on the JET program. I studied, and thankfully, you know, Mandarin has a shared elements with the written structure of Japanese. And so I was able to leverage the Mandarin writing characters I had learned at Augie into my study of Japanese.
Okay. And JET, for those who haven't heard it, I don't know if this is what the acronym stands for, but it means Japan English Teaching and getting people to Japan to teach English. So,
yes. Yeah,
oh, that's fantastic. Exactly. Friends, my guest is Melinda Pavek, a retired senior foreign service officer for the United States State Department. Trust me when I say the conversation is just beginning. We're still in Nepal, but I have a feeling we're going to rack up some frequent flyer miles here as time goes by. You are listening to The Conversation on WVIK and a chat with Melinda Pavek. We're going to take a bit of a break here, and we'll be back in just a moment. We hope you will stay tuned on your public radio station, 90.3 FM and WVIK.org.
Support for WVIK comes from Eye Surgeons Associates, providing eye care to the Quad Cities for over 40 years. Services include eye exams, cataract surgery, LASIK, and retina care, with locations in Bettendorf, DeWitt, Muscatine, Rock Island, and Geneseo. More at esaeyecare.com.
Kick off your weekend with What's Happening QC, your guide to concerts, festivals, and events around the Quad Cities, made possible by Seifert Building Supplies. Fridays at 8:01 a.m. on WVIK Classical. And remember, subscribe to What's Happening QC wherever you get your podcasts. What's Happening QC?
I'm Bill Hannon from Moline, and WVIK is my NPR station.
Welcome back to The Conversation on WVIK. In a chat with this week's guest, Melinda Pavek, a retired senior foreign service officer for the State Department. And Melinda, I'm so sorry that I had to break into your wonderful narrative, but we were in Nepal, but I think we were about to start going other places. How would you like to pick up the story from there?
Well, next I went off to Kingston, Jamaica to do one of the roles that is quintessential key foreign service, which is to work in the consular section, supporting Americans and issuing visas.
Very important work, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Very important.
And but when people hear, oh, you're going to be in Jamaica, they they might think, oh, how idyllic. But I can't imagine you ever had a week that was as short as 40 hours.
Oh, and there was a strong demand for visas in Jamaica. And there was also just Kingston is not the part of Jamaica that most people travel to when they go on vacation. Kingston has a whole lot of elements that I loved, but it is a little gritty.
Well, yeah. So what now are you also, I imagine you're helping Americans when they get into trouble and lose passports and things like that.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And the interesting thing about working in a place like Jamaica is you get a little bit of everything. You know, you get crisis response. So while I was there, there was a big hurricane that ended up needing a lot of response. But you also get Americans that come and get into trouble of their own making or, you know, have accidents. I will still remember there was one Easter weekend when I was the duty officer, and there was a horrific car crash, and two people died in the car crash. There was a child on life support, and it was my responsibility to call a grandmother to let her know that her her child had passed, and her grandchild needed help. And it was a really, really challenging weekend.
Oh, dear. I can only imagine. You mentioned the disaster that occurred there. And what role does the State Department play in serving as a conduit? Because one of the great things about America historically is that when our friends have been in need, we show up. And I don't know, following a disaster is part of that coordinating American relief efforts for the nation, the affected nation?
Absolutely. And you know, when the U.S. Agency for International Development existed before January, they would have specialists that did humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. And so they would have locations around the world where, there were, again, common like a hurricane. You know, the region, the Caribbean region has a lot of hurricanes and there's a lot of struggles to respond. And so they would have relief supplies that would be available. But the U.S. Tries to be very respectful of waiting until a nation asks for assistance.
Right.
Many nations are perfectly capable of managing disasters to a certain degree, but then they need specific kinds of assistance that they will ask for help. And so that's, through USAID, that is how we would coordinate the requests for assistance and work across the U.S. interagency to identify where the resources might be able to come from to respond to those requests.
I want to take a little side detour here, if I may, and only to the extent you're comfortable. But you mentioned that USAID has been dismantled, and there's been a movement over the last over the course of this administration where it seems to be a lot of retrenchment for a variety of reasons, including economic. But then there's an argument that if it is. Penny wise, which not a lot of people think it is, it's been terribly pound foolish. I don't know if you have any observations on that you might care to share about the role that America plays on the global stage.
Yeah, I'm grateful that I am now retired, and my heart is just distraught over what is being done to the role of the US on the global stage. I think that there is a lot of misunderstanding about how much of US taxpayer resources are used in international locations. The cost or the amount is less than 1% of the US total budget that is used for international collaboration and international humanitarian assistance and disaster response. And the programs that were run by USAID, the US Department of State, and other US government agencies. But the kinds of returns that those programs brought to US citizens, US businesses, US educational institutions cannot be valued to the degree that they're an exponential return. You know, when you're investing in the stock market, if you get a 6, 7, or 8% return, you are thrilled. But the investments the US government has made in these programs internationally has gotten us 100, 200, 1,000% return over the course of the last several decades. And so I think it's really, unfortunately, as you said, very pound foolish for us to walk away from the roles and the leadership that we have played.
Yeah. You hit on it there. I try to make that argument. It is, of course, the prerogative of an administration to make decisions that are political, policy, philosophical, whether that's with a uppercase or lowercase p, and how many quotes you put around it. But when you just boil it down to finance, I mean, for instance, in AIDS prevention, it's like a penny that we spend on that redounds to our benefit in the hundreds, if not thousands, and tens of thousands of dollars in terms of global health stability. It's crazy that you, for ideological reasons, and again, that's the prerogative of an administration to be ideological, but to do so baldly in the face of economic nonsense. I can only imagine what your perspective is in watching this, witnessing this happen, something that you gave decades of your life to.
And that's the role of foreign service officers and the role of people who work in the US government is to support administrations, regardless of which party is in the leadership role. We exist to be nonpartisan and to support US citizen interests. And so I think that's an important component is that, you know, there's this idea of the deep state. Well, the deep state it exists in someone's mind who wants to create an enemy. But the reality is that no matter what administration is in the elected leadership role, we're working to support that administration's priorities within the constitutional constraints, within the legal environment, within, you know, the laws of our democracy. And that's what every public servant, public service, foreign service officer is doing. And so it's unfortunate that many public servants have become targets when people don't seem to understand how much we really care about what we are trying to do for the US taxpayer, US citizen.
Well, I'm going to try to avoid getting too ideological, but I still will be very much partisan that I don't think there's been any better solution to the question of how to run a great society than America's answer has been historically. And we'll come back to the more of that in just a minute, because actually, Melinda Pavek and I have a lot of globetrotting to do, but I'm reminded that the local historian John Hallberg challenged us to consider the wonders of the world close at hand. And for that, Melinda and I are going to step aside and make space for the beloved Dr. Roald Tweet and this week's installment of Rock Island Lines.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. Father Bon was one of Rock Island's saints. He lived in a dark two-room basement apartment with a hot plate in a dying corner of Davenport, Iowa, across the river. He'd retired from the priesthood, but often from his small cupboard he fed the hungry with rabbit stew, clothed the poor, and uplifted the drowning in spirit. I got to know him because he supplemented his small pension by teaching writing classes part-time at local colleges, and he became my colleague for 2 years. I was adequately clothed and far too well fed, but he had a richer gift for me. With the wisdom of a Jesuit's lifetime of disciplined study, he had narrowed the 339 rules of correct writing in the typical freshman reader down to 2. Rule number 1, he told his students, see what's there. And rule 2, tell the truth. See what's there and tell the truth. Pay attention, Father Bon was saying. What else is there to an education? The good lawyer, the good doctor, the good carpenter, mother, father, have become good at their jobs because they have learned to pay attention to smaller and smaller clues. I erased my own blackboard of comma splices and fragments and dangling modifiers. Father's students found these simple rules very hard, for we Americans are restless. Lest we should miss something, we rush around the world collecting airports while overlooking our own backyards. Every catalog has something new to order. The painter Cezanne once remarked that he could spend his whole life painting from one spot just by turning from left to right. That's what Father Bon taught. At this very moment, in the northeast corner of your own backyard, what battles are taking place in the perennials? Fights for life between spider and fly, robin and worm. What news from the front lines of the marching red ants? Is the high castle in the apple branches safe? If you don't stop and see what's there and tell the world, who will?
Rock Island Lines with Roald Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And friends, it is available to you thanks to folks just like you supporting WVIK. You can do so by hopping over to WVIK.org and hitting that not-so-subtle donate button to keep programs like this on the air and programs like The Conversation on WVIK. My guest this week is Melinda Pavek, a retired senior foreign service officer with the State Department. And Melinda, I just want to say again, I'm so grateful that we get some time with you in all your globetrotting because you just came back from like Antarctica. You don't even have to travel for work and you're still traveling.
Yes, hi. It's interesting. As I was in my career, I kept thinking, all right, I've traveled and I've seen a lot of wonderful places and met wonderful people. So if I'm going to plan on a retirement trip, where should it be? And I didn't think the State Department was ever going to send me to Antarctica. So I decided that that was going to be my retirement gift to myself. And when I retired at the end of November, I was grateful to find a wonderful trip to the Antarctic Circle that I just returned from.
Well, I do want to keep up with this wonderful career of yours. So we were in Jamaica. And then in between these postings, do you get a little bit of breathing space or do you then get the next appointment and then head off?
Often there's a little bit of training that you need to do between assignments. And then there's also something that is required under the Foreign Service Act called home leave. And home leave is when you are mandatorily required to return to the United States and reconnect yourself with the people and places and ideas of the United States. It's an idea, of course, that was created long before social media and email and voice over internet phone and all of that. Mm. But it's still something that is very valuable to Foreign Service officers, the opportunity to be home and reconnect with family and friends and do all of those mandatory doctor's appointments and things that have to be done in person.
So a little bit of prose and a little bit of poetry, remembering what's so special about this particular nation. After that home leave, then where did you go after Jamaica?
Well, then I next went to Baghdad, Iraq for a year. And my role there was also, again, in the management section. And so I had the opportunity there to move us or help to move us from palace, Saddam Hussein's palace that we had been operating in from 2003 until our new embassy compound was completed. And so it was completed while I was there, and I had an opportunity to help move us over to our new embassy compound and get our teams settled into our new working space and our new living space.
Now, these were not calm days, right? In Baghdad and Iraq?
Yeah, it was a challenge. In fact, within the first week that I was there, a friend from my training class actually was killed.
I'm sorry.
And it was, that's one of the challenges of this Foreign Service career is that you just never know. So it was a good reminder that you just never know how much time is left. He died doing something he really, really cared about. And his family knew how much he valued the opportunity to be there and make a difference. Mm. And so, but still it was definitely a challenging time to be there. But while I was there, we did turn over a responsibility for managing the security, the green zone security areas to the government of Iraq. And one of the interesting projects I worked on was actually, I was a member of the team that helped to catalog and then return to the government of Iraq the various pieces of loot that that the U.S. military had gathered together when Saddam Hussein's regime fell. And so that was a really unique place to be in history.
I can only imagine. My goodness. Well, I think we could spend a whole hour talking about that, but we're going to run out of time here before we know it. So after Baghdad, hopefully they gave you something cushy, Tahiti, maybe?
After Baghdad, I chose to go to the wonderful city of Lahore, Pakistan for 2 years. And Lahore is a delight. Also, some security challenges that got worse, unfortunately, while I was there, but it was not my fault.
Wait a minute. We're going to have to pause there for a second. I just thought you were talking broadly about the international world, global security system, but you got to tell us a little more.
It was at the time, Pakistan is a young nation and a nation of people from diverse backgrounds, diverse perspectives, just like our own, in fact. Mm-hmm. And they were struggling with, people who felt like they didn't matter. And the only way to matter was to be involved in terrorism related activities. And so unfortunately, the city of Lahore is a large city, and it's a historic and beautiful city. And for a long time, a lot of the terrorism issues were not impacting Lahore. But while I was there, there were a series of bombings that were coordinated, and it definitely raised the issue of security challenges that we needed to address in order to keep our teams safe. It was a challenging time.
Well, and it just reminds me the debt that we owe to people who answer the calling you answered, and we don't have to think about it. And that's part of that debt of gratitude, is that so much of the world exists in a different level of insecurity that we become, I think, blinded to the gift that is our base level security. I mean, people want to roil the waters all the time here, even in River City, but thanks to folks like you and people around the world, we live in an immense amount, a privileged amount of security. So on behalf of everybody, Melinda, I'm going to say thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Kai. That's very meaningful.
Well, but your journeys are not done, because some of the most colorful things I've tracked you doing are yet to come. After Pakistan and Lahore, where did you go?
Then I came back to Washington, where I was here for about a year, learning how to, work within the Washington apparatus. I was a special assistant, which is essentially someone who supports a principal. In this case, I was supporting the assistant secretary for administration at the State Department. And so, it was a good opportunity to learn how the State Department works. In Washington, where most of our colleagues are civil service colleagues, which are slightly different than foreign service. But you're also working a lot with the U.S. government interagency. So it was a really interesting learning opportunity. And I had a great assistant secretary.
Oh, that's good news. But and you then, got wanderlust.
Yes. Well, and then I had the opportunity, which was really fantastic, to become the deputy chief of mission at our embassy in Bandar Seri Begawan, Brunei. And so I wandered off to Brunei, which is, on the island of Borneo, and spent a couple of years doing a lot of wonderful things, because Brunei was, for the first time in many years, was the chair of ASEAN, which is, a grouping of 10 Southeast Asian nations that work together. And Brunei was chairing the meetings that ASEAN was having that year, which meant that we were having the Secretary of State visited four times within a year, which was the first time a Secretary of State had visited our embassy in Brunei in more than a decade. So, but we had four visits that year. We coordinated the planning for a presidential visit. President Obama was coming. Unfortunately, President Obama had to cancel his visit with one day's notice because a long government shutdown, if you can recall, at that point. And the president needed to stay in Washington in order to negotiate reopening the government. So that was a great disappointment to our team, because we had all of the plans in place. But the Secretary of State came to represent the president instead. And so we also hosted a round of Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations during that year. We had a couple of Secretary of Defense visits because Brunei was looking at buying some U.S. military equipment. And so, it was a fantastic year. Fantastic couple of years, but that one year was very intense.
Yeah. Well, I hate to say it, I'm getting antsy because I want to get to this Consul General stuff.
Oh, okay.
Did that happen after Brunei?
Then after Brunei, I went back to Islamabad for 2 years.
Cool.
And then after Islamabad, I went to Japan, where I studied Japanese. And then I was at our embassy in Tokyo doing environment, science, technology, and health work. And then I went on to be the consul general in Kolkata. So there's a lot of things that happened in the last 22 years.
Well, and you see, okay, so I've been a Facebook friend of yours, and to follow these things and to see not just the interesting places you go, but your spheres of influence. Now, a consul general is not too far below in the org chart an ambassador. And for a valued partner nation like India, I imagine that's even more important. But what are some favorite memories of being Consul General in Kolkata?
Well, Kolkata is just a fantastic city in general. So when you look at the history of India and, you know, the British East India Company had its headquarters in Kolkata. And so Kolkata was an original capital of India. So there's just fantastic history there. And the people are so proud of it. And they should be, because it's a challenging history, just like some of the history in the United States. But at the same time, if you don't remember your history, you're destined to repeat it,
exactly.
Especially the bad aspects of it. So yeah, it was really great to be there. I was responsible not only for, of course, Kolkata, which is in the state of West Bengal, but I was responsible for 11 states in East and Northeast India, which have a population of about 300 million people. Mm. So about, you know, just under the size of the United States,
exactly.
But in only a small portion of India. And it's an area of India that is among the poorest. Two of the states have some of the worst economic situations for their people. And then Northeast India, which is an area where very few people even recognize that it is India. It's connected to the main part of India by a very narrow strip of land. It's only about 12 miles across this strip. And it's called the Chicken's Neck. And so for many years, the government of India did not really do much for the northeastern states, viewed that part of India as kind of a buffer zone between India and China, India and Myanmar, India and Nepal, etc. Mm-hmm. But they were really doing a lot of investments in Northeast India when I was there. And so we had an opportunity post-pandemic to really do some great collaboration and identify common goals. Some of the states of Northeast India have very high HIV prevalence. Mm. Some of the states of Northeast India have really strong connections to American Baptist missionaries. Mm-hmm. That go back to the 1850s, 1860s. And so so there's a lot of history. There's also a lot of history related to World War II. For folks who are interested in the people who were flying the hump in order to, the hump is...
Yep.
Northeast India.
And so getting into China,
what
right.
we were, yeah, a lot yeah. of what we were doing was actually helping the U.S. Department of Defense, who is still trying to find the remains of those missing in action, killed in action, flying the hump.
Oh, boy.
And recover remains and bring them back to their families.
Well,
and so.
Yeah. Well, guess what, Melinda? I knew this was going to happen. We're out of time. You have to come back on the show. Will you do that for me?
Absolutely.
I feel really bad about this because the whole conversation's been great. So I can't say it's getting good. It's been great. But I have to say now, thanks to my guest, Melinda Pavek, retired Foreign Service Officer with the State Department. Melinda, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kai. It's been really a delight to
be
here.
Okay. Well, and you just stick around for just a second while I remind friends, remember that you can catch the conversation twice each week on WVIK, Saturday morning live at 10 o'clock, right before Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. The rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8, right after Fresh Air. You can also find recent episodes at WVIK.org. And just look for us under the podcast tab. From the campus of Augustana College in Rock Island, this is Kai Swanson inviting you to join us next week for The Conversation on Quad Cities NPR WVIK.
Support for WVIK, Quad Cities NPR, comes from the Regional Development Authority, distributing funds from the Rhythm City Casino Resort to help make the Quad Cities a more vibrant and inclusive community. Learn more at rdauthority.org.
I'm Linda Manning from Bettendorf, and WVIK is my NPR station.
On the next Throughline from NPR, the rupture between Iran and Israel through the story of Jewish Iranians.
Saturdays at 7 p.m. on WVIK. It's the button you can set just for NPR News here in the Iowa, Illinois area. WVIK, 90.3 FM and HD Rock Island, along with 95.9 FM, K240 DZ Dubuque. WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.